incitement of insurrectionist violence against this country. Vice President Mike Pence has not ruled out invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office either. All this in the midst of growing calls among U.S. legislators to impeach the president following the Capitol riot on Wednesday. Now, some believe this is karma. They argue that Washington has fanned flames all over the world for long years, and it's now paying the price. Some others believe this is the beginning of the end of America. Is this the democracy Washington has always boasted of? Stay with us for a debate.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
What President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
Okay, now let's get going with the show. Joining me in this debate will be Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor with the University of Wisconsin, also a veteran peace activist out of Madison. And also we have Omali Yeshitela, activist and founder of the Uhuru Movement and also chairman of African People's Socialist Party from St. Petersburg, Florida. Welcome to the show. Let's start with Frank. Some analysts maintain that America's power was already in decline long before Trump took office in the past 4 years, a further discredited the notion that U.S. should be in charge on the world stage. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that the world has become more multipolar in the last 10 years. Clearly, China has become more powerful. Russia has become stabilized and becoming more powerful, and the European Union has also become strengthened. So clearly, there's a shift in the relative power. But the United States military is still the most powerful entity on Earth. Its budget is five or six times the combined budget of all the others. But I think the issue of soft power, of our ability, of the United States' ability to lead, which is what you were alluding to in the introduction, that's another story. And what we saw in Washington on Wednesday, which is the beginning, not the end, it's the beginning of what we're going to see as unrest over the next week, indicates that there is a serious, serious crisis, and the moral authority of this country, that is really what the other leaders of the world put in question.
Okay, now let's turn to St. Petersburg. O'Malley, given the goings-on on Capitol Hill, can Washington lecture others on democracy and human rights?
Well, the truth is Washington should never have been able to lecture other countries on the question of democracy and human rights. And it's only because many peoples around the world, including leaders of other countries and liberals, white liberals, and others in this country, would dismiss or understate the significance of the ongoing historical oppression of African people, the indigenous people in this country. The fact that it is the memory of this country does not include recognition of the genocide that stole this land, this indigenous land that's responsible for thousands of millions of people living in concentration camps that they call Indian reservations. And the reality is that the American Empire started at the moment Europeans came here, took this land, kidnapped African people, and worked us like beasts. And that has never stopped. And even before anything that we're talking about now that happened on January 6th occurred, we were seeing Africans killed, shot down in the streets in this country on a regular basis, or killed in other fashions. We got this huge population of African people locked in the prisons. One out of every eight human beings on earth who's in prison is an African in the United States. And the fact that this has never been the kind of issue it should be, has never grabbed the attention of the human rights activists in Europe, the great leaders who are now condemning, talking about America pretending to be democratic. The only reason America could pretend to be democratic all those times is because what has happened to African people here has been dismissed. And we talk about America as soft power, but it's the gun that has always been able to influence any narrative, any discussion about America. There was no democracy that was responsible for Mossadegh's overthrow, for Abin's overthrow in Guatemala, just the whole horror, terror that America has waged around the world. So that now what has happened is the political significance, the political power of this country is called into question by what people have just seen with this assault on the Capitol. And I might say, finally, that while January 6th was an attack on the U.S. government, the U.S. government is always making attacks on African people inside this country and various other places around the world. So that's the significance of it. To me, as the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party.
Okay. Uhuru. Now, Frank, let's take a little glance at a U.S. foreign policy. You see Washington abandoning international agreements and deals, among them, we can say, the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and these during Trump's term in office. Has this benefited the U.S. or harmed it?
Well, it depends who, you know, and what treaties you're talking about. The United States is still committed to military engagements around the world. The United States, in spite of needling the Europeans, is still committed to NATO. So on the military front, the United States has not pulled back from treaties. On other things, the United States has tried to maneuver the trade treaties and others to the benefit of the top American corporations and industrialists. And so far as I can see, the treaties, the trade treaties and things like that, have undermined the standard of living of most working people. So you have to say who benefits, you know, here with some of these treaties. Who benefits by free flow of capital? Not 95% of the people who have no capital. So I don't think that's a good way to phrase the question. We have withdrawn, the United States withdrawn from treaties that President Trump feels hurts the fossil fuel industry, which is one of his major supporters. So we leave the climate accord. Well, does that help or hurt humanity and this country? It hurts us, obviously, but it helps a segment of the population or of the companies that he's willing to help. So there's always contradictory things here, but mostly the withdrawal from the treaties you're talking about hurts people.
Well, I think it should be also mentioned that most of the treaties that we are talking about, especially that's come under assault with the election of Donald J. Trump, are arrangements that came into existence with the so-called Atlanticist group following the Second Imperialist World War. and where the UN, the NATO, many of the trade agreements were created. And what Trump, and this is something that was done in part to curtail the Soviet Union, to also make it difficult for Germany to be continue as the threat that they had been defined as over the last period. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the logic of NATO should have been gone. The point, however, is that there has been a weakening of this and a challenge to the Atlanticist arrangement, and Trump came into power attacking that, attacking the United Nations, attacking NATO, et cetera. And the U.S. Is in a state of decline. There's a certain sector of the rulers in this country and much of what is called the Western world that was connected to the Atlanticist arrangement. That's obviously been kicked asunder.
Now, Frank, the U.S. invaded Iraq on baseless grounds and in violation of international law. It funded ISIS terrorists to oust Syria's President Assad from power. It deployed further firepower to the already tense Persian Gulf region. And the list goes on and on. And the funny thing is it blames others for destabilizing this part of the world. What's the U.S. agenda for West Asia?
Well, again, I think there's more than one agenda. And I think we'll see whether Biden's agenda is going to be as aggressive. Clearly, the United States, under Trump, shifted its already pro-Israeli position to basically agreeing to whatever Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted to do, based partially on a power politics and partially on a support of a wealthy and right-wing section of the population here. So I don't think it's easy to say that you have the policy. I think right now one of the issues is going to be exactly what policy. Biden is going to be under tremendous pressure, both internationally and also, I think, internally, to pull back a little bit from his pro-Israeli position. There's already, we'll see if it's real, a commitment on the Biden part to meet back with Iran and see if we can restart the treaty again. We'll see. You know, but there's also countervailing pressures, particularly on China, where you have a partially xenophobic and racist attitude towards China, but also clearly there has to be a change in our policy of hostility if we're going to have a stable world. And Biden has to respond to that. Now, hopefully he's going to withdraw from the gamesmanship of the Trump administration, the attacks on China, the arrest of Chinese citizens here when they're doing business, and so forth. We'll see. And that's going to be up to people in this country, it seems to me, to build the kind of movement that says, here is the kind of world we want, and fight for that kind of world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, President Trump was also blaming his predecessor for, you know, American boots on Afghanistan.
He'll blame anybody. He'll blame anybody. And he's taking advantage of failures in the previous administration. We never should have been in Afghanistan in the first place. Clearly, the invasion of Iraq was a fraud. And these things were never really dealt with, any more than the real issue of slavery was dealt with here. So, you know, you have these overhanging disasters, and a Biden administration, if they're going to succeed, if they're going to reach the 72 million people who are in the street who have voted for Trump, they're going to have to do something that clearly responds to some of the anger, and some of the anger is well placed. We shouldn't have troops all over the world. It's a bad idea. And he has to respond to that.
Yep.
And if he doesn't, I think that we will continue to go down the rabbit hole and really have disaster.
Yeah, we'll wait and see. Now, O'Malley, speaking of international accords and treaties, the U.S. has not ratified such accords like the one on preservation of oceans, whatever related to environment protection. On the rights of women, children, disabled in the states, it has not regulated arms sales and cluster bombs. It has not ratified the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. It left a number of UN agencies. Is America not a member of the international community? Why shouldn't it commit itself to such treaties?
Well, the fact is, America, its agenda is world domination. It always has been. And in terms of treaties, I mean, that it makes treaties that facilitates its agenda to maintain world domination and the capitalist social system, which is based on genocide, and is a parasite. A global parasite that's backed up with tremendous weaponry. And I think that part of what we cannot have this discussion without recognizing is that peoples around the world want to be free. Ultimately, it's not going to be simply up to Israel or up to the United States. I mean, Arab Palestinian people want to be free. Africans in the United States and around the world want to be free. And so I guarantee you that what you'll see moving forward is that the people are going to become a bigger factor in determining how things evolve. It won't just be the United States. It won't be just Biden. Biden is going to make certain kinds of overtures because the capitalists in this country are concerned in part about the kind of uncertainty that the Trump administration has met, even though he was shoveling trillions of dollars into their coffers on the one hand. On the other hand, it was an element of economic and political uncertainty that they didn't like. Biden is Trump-like. That's why Biden was the Democratic Party response to Trump. He is Trump-like, and he can maneuver more effectively than Trump could. I don't think you're going to see some dressing up of the policies. There are certain policies that are never going to change, essentially, that Trump initiated. The struggle with China, that's going to be here. That's permanent. Because there's a real contest, and it's an existential crisis that the United States is confronted right now, just in terms of losing its significance, losing its place in the world, and other countries on the ascendancy, and peoples around the world fighting to take back our resources, our sovereignty, and our dignity. So it's not going to be just something that Trump decides or Biden decides. I'm going to be a part of that decision, as are other peoples around the world who are determined not to live under the boot of U.S. imperialism any longer.
Now, Frank O'Malley spoke of some policy change maybe under the Biden administration. Do you expect to see change in U.S. foreign policy under Joe Biden?
I don't expect a sea change. I expect an amelioration of some things. I expect that we'll be back on the climate treaty and the World Health Organization. There will be an overture towards Iran to try to restart the treaty, but there are obviously questions there where people in the Biden administration want to talk about other things that were not in the treaty, including the missiles and so forth, and preconditions and whatnot, which have already Iran has already said they're not going to do that. We have a treaty, they said, let's enforce it. Well, we'll see if Biden does that. But those are not, that, with possible exception of that, that's not a sea change. A sea change would be a willingness to recognize that we're not going to be in charge anymore. And I don't see that happening any more than the other person, people on the broadcast do. I do think that it is possible. It's possible. I'm not saying it's probable, but I'm saying it is possible that with a strong enough movement in this country, we may be able to insist on a less aggressive foreign policy.
Right. O'Malley, some observers argue that a U.S. empire is falling apart from within. What's your assessment? What direction is the U.S. heading for?
I mean, I think it may look like it's happening from within, but what we have to remember is the whole capitalist system. The United States is the big dog. It's the hegemon around which the, everything revolves at this point, even if it's in a shaky position. And so people struggle around the world. I mean, you've got an economy where 80% of the people on the planet Earth are trying to survive off less than $10 a day, 50% of the people on Earth trying to survive off $2.50 or less a day. And that's because of resources that are being stolen, ripped off from other peoples and countries around the world on a stolen land. You've got a settler colony here that's reaching out and stealing people's resources. So people in the process of trying to feed their own children and trying to guarantee a future for themselves are almost always having to go up against the United States and taking back resources. And I think this has contributed to the United States, the economic spiral downward. And then, of course, as has been mentioned, China is a big contender, too. So the United States doesn't have a free control in any place in the world, not in Asia, not even in Africa, where China is the fastest-growing economic force inside Africa. The United States and Europe have been the ones who have been able to hold that under their sphere of influence. So the struggles of peoples around the world affect the political situation inside the United States, and in so doing, it affects the political situation. It affects the economic, And doing that, it affects the political situation,
right?
Because the people who have accustomed to living off the resources from the peoples around the world can't do it anymore. That's an economic problem. That's part of what, what they're having to deal with.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this debate here on Press TV. Let me thank Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor with the University of Wisconsin and a veteran peace activist from Madison, and also Mali Yeshitela, activist and founder of the Huru Movement and chairman of African People's Socialist Party from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Al-Mulku yawma idhin lillahi بينهم الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات في جنات النعيم.
All sovereignty that day is for Allah. He will judge between them. So they who believed and did righteous deeds will be in gardens of pleasure.
Dear listeners, in the previous program, we talked about the 55th verse of the chapter, and we concluded that being in doubt forever will lead to aberration, and the result is nothing but chastisement of a barren day. And the reason why it's called the barren day might be is that it leaves no chance for making up and compensation. But in this verse, the 56th one, the Holy Quran says, "Al-mulku yawma idhin lillah." On that day, the sovereignty will be Allah's. يَحْكُمُ بَيْنَهُمْ. He will judge between them. فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ. And those who believe and do righteous deeds will be in gardens of bliss. So in this part, The Holy Quran is pointing to the absolute sovereignty of the Almighty Allah on that day, the day of resurrection. And it says, الْمُلْكُ يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلَّهِ. On that day, the sovereignty will be Allah's. This, of course, does not allocate to the resurrection day, because today and always the absolute sovereignty belongs to Allah. Yet, since there are some other kinds of owners and rulers who count themselves actually as owners and true rulers in this world too, there may arise this thought that there are some rulers and owners other than Allah. But on the day of hereafter, where all these matters are absent, this fact will be made manifest more than any other times, and all will understand that the true ruler and owner is only the one Almighty Allah. And of course, it cannot be taken into consideration, this ownership of this world. The realm of the authorities in this world is really limited and weak. But anyway, on that day, there will be no one thinking other than the Almighty Allah. And it should be noted and taken into account that the criterion of Allah's judgment on the day of hereafter will be the belief and disbelief of human beings. يَحْكُمُ بَيْنَهُمْ. He will judge between them. فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ. Those who believe and, of course, based on this belief, did the righteous deeds, فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ, will be in the gardens of bliss. This is one part of the judgment of the Almighty Allah. The second part, of course, will be said in the next verse, وَالَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا وَكَذَّبُوا بِآيَاتِنَا. But we will talk about that later on.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In
this
series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
We talked about the judgment of the Almighty Allah, criterion of that, and we concluded that Al-Mulku Yawma'idhin Lillah means on that day the sovereignty will be Allah's. Means there are two kinds of sovereignties and ownerships. The first is the true sovereignties, which is the sovereignty of creator over the creatures. And the second is the nominal and conventional sovereignty, which is current among the usual people. But what is important is that these two both exist in this world, but in hereafter, all the nominal, all the conventional sovereignties will be dismissed, and there will remain only the true sovereignty of the creator of the worlds. However, since the true owner is Allah, he will be the true ruler too. Anyway, He will govern over and judge between all human beings, whether they are believers or disbelievers. The consequence of which is the same thing that the Holy Quran has stated at the end of this holy verse. It says, فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ. Those who believe and do righteous deeds will be in gardens of bliss. So, you may have understood up to now that at first it says آمَنُوا and then it says عَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. Means doing righteous deeds cannot happen unless you have a firm belief and thought beforehand. Since the verse says اللَّهُ يَحْكُمُ بَيْنَهُمْ, the Almighty Allah will judge between them, and they will be of two groups. The first group were the believers, the ones who were doing the righteous deeds. The end of these people will be the gardens of bliss. The next group we will talk about, inshallah, in the later program with the 57th verse. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
The parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen's Marib have halted the process of 10 prisoner swap deals that would release more than 300 prisoners from both sides. The exchange was a part of an agreement reached recently between the warring local parties. An official of the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs blames the mercenaries for the halt.
When tribal mediators are involved in the release of the prisoners, the mercenaries stop them. This is also true about these exchanges that include more than 300 prisoners. The mercenaries are not one party, but rather they are several parties. And whenever we agree with one party, the other side fails it.
This comes while the Yemeni army has made significant achievements in advancing towards the city of Marib to liberate it. Halting the prisoner swap will put more pressure on the Yemeni army to stop the advance of coalition forces on the ground.
The coalition forces play several cards to stop the army's advance toward Marib in order to win a battle that will liberate the city. Halting the prisoner exchange is one of those. This is another effort by Saudi-led coalition to pressure the Yemeni army.
The prisoners committee was able to liberate hundreds of prisoners during 2020 through local negotiations without any international mediation. However, the Saudi-led coalition seeks to stop the humanitarian process.
Thousands of Yemenis are still in prisons waiting for the United Nations to stop the delays in the release and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to commit to its obligation. Abdul Latif Al-Washalib, Sana'a.
We
Iranian experts and ophthalmologists have gathered in Tehran to unveil a new method in eye surgery which enables the doctors to cure problems in their offices without anesthesia and bleeding. Panis Plexer offers an alternative to invasive surgical procedures, reducing recovery time and any complications that can arise before and after surgery. It is an innovative development in eye treatments by utilizing the fourth state of matter, or plasma.
This new technique that uses plasma is being practiced for the first time. Within the past 20 years, plasma has been used in dentistry, treatment of cancer, and scar healing. Since some years ago, we decided to use it in ophthalmology to make sure it is safe. Almost 15 eye diseases can be cured at the doctor's office without going to the surgery room.
This is an international event to unveil a low-cost method for eye disorder treatments. It is a pain-free Iranian method called PANIS, or plasma-assisted non-invasive surgery. This is a result of 5 years of collaboration between two Iranian companies and an Italian counterpart.
This method has been practiced in many countries, but Iranian scientists have now turned it to a method to decrease treatment costs, as it does not need surgery rooms and hospital beds. Such outstanding achievements show that the sanctions by the West have not been able to slow down Iran's advancement, proving that the Islamic Republic is moving forward on the right track. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
For refugees in reception camps in Greece, it has been a year of fires, double displacement, and now COVID-19. With rolling lockdowns enforced since March, along with restrictions that have only served to make unbearable living conditions even worse. In response to this, independent groups have sprung up and are trying to make a difference. Yellow Days is one of them, empowering forced migrants and changing the narrative surrounding their circumstances lies at the heart of everything they do. The friendships forged during Yellow Days festivals have lasted, and although COVID-19 prevented them from getting together in 2020, the team is still busy making magic happen online.
We have this, you know, distortionate idea of feeling that the refugee community has poor people, they're waiting to be helped, they're just depressed and waiting for answers, and it's far from the reality that I have experienced, especially with all my forced migrant friends. They're people that are active, they're people with loads of skill, power and talent, and all that we do at the Yellow Days is bring all those people together.
Yellow Days is run by a core group of 8 women, which members say is one of its most important aspects. One of the primary goals of groups like this is creating a model for a more sustainable future, not only for forced migrants and minorities, but the entire human race.
Because our system of capitalism and white supremacy, what we definitely know is that we can't rely on governments to help, and the media propaganda machine is so well financed and consistent that we are lacking not just political will but also human will. And I think this isn't really a time this year with COVID and 2020, this has also been a time for people to start waking up to their own power.
The International Rescue Committee says depression, post-traumatic stress disorder and self-harm that are the byproducts of hopelessness and despair have spiked amid COVID-19 restrictions. With the majority of asylum applications on pause, there's no means of escape, and during COVID-19, self-isolating often means being locked in a shipping container with many others.
More than half of those surveyed said that COVID has caused them depression, worry, anxiety and loneliness.
Every year, tens of thousands of refugees reach Greek shores. The media has aided the dehumanization of asylum seekers by reducing them to just that, a statistic. But there are still those fighting for stories to be told and lives celebrated. Bianca Rahimi, London.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, came down hard on the United States and its allies over their years-long sanctions against the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei has stressed that the measures are based on a baseless animosity and have to be lifted right away. Iran's leader noted that setting conditions for the removal of sanctions is nonsense. He said a possible U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningless if the sanctions stay in place. Ayatollah Khamenei threw his weight behind a recent move by the Iranian government to scale down its commitments under the deal known as the JCPOA, saying that Tehran will not accept any obligations without reciprocal measures, adding that it would be meaningless for the Islamic Republic to implement all its commitments under the JCPOA when the other side implements almost none of its. Ayatollah Khamenei slammed comments made by some Western countries over Iran's regional policies. He has stressed that Tehran will continue to play its role for regional stability, like its recent contribution to Iraq and Syria that led to the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group there. The Iran leader said that it is the U.S. that finds its interest in destabilizing the region, noting that such plots have been explicitly stated by some American thinkers, including someone from the American Enterprise Institute. Speaking on Iran's defense capabilities, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the country is strong enough now to deter a war similar to the one launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein with arms and backing of the West in the 1980s. Iran's leader then touched upon recent developments surrounding the U.S. presidential election, saying the so-called American values and democracy have turned into a laughingstock even among American friends. He said what happened in Washington, D.C. was the very thing Americans were planning to incite in Iran over a decade ago.
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has finally declared there will be an orderly transition of power. The news comes after violence in the nation's capital as Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building while lawmakers met to certify President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. World leaders joined the chorus of outrage condemning the outgoing president for stoking the unrest. For weeks he undermined the result, claiming election fraud, and then rallied protesters to head to the Capitol. As angry demonstrators stormed Congress, one woman was shot dead by police and three others died of, quote, medical emergencies. An improvised explosive device was also intercepted by authorities. As the situation deteriorated, fellow Republicans urged Trump to call his protest off. Hours later, he posted a video reiterating his claims of fraud. He also cheered his supporters, saying he loved them and described them as special, but called on them to remain calm and return home. In an unprecedented step, Twitter took down the video and suspended his account, threatening permanent suspension if he continued to violate the social media platform. President of the European Council, Charles Michel, took to Twitter to voice his concerns. He joined world leaders calling for a peaceful transfer of power. Earlier, UK Home Secretary Priti Patel was asked about Trump's role in stoking anger and mistrust in the electoral process.
We've just seen, you know, confidence in democracy being shattered, quite frankly, and there's no justification for the level of violence, full stop, that was on show and has been on display, and people have been assaulted, people have died. The violence, you know, should stop, and he should absolutely condemn everything that has taken place.
In the early hours, Republican Senator Mitt Romney blamed President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection. He also downplayed suggestions of a congressional audit to placate angry Trump supporters.
For any who remain insistent on an audit in order to satisfy the many people who believe that the election was stolen, I'd offer this perspective. No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen.
Many predicted unrest, but Wednesday's scenes went beyond expectation. Four people dead, with lawmakers having to cower and abandon the historic building. In less than 2 weeks, President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated in the very same building, but with scenes of unrest, authorities will be bracing for more potential chaos, as the world watches the most powerful nation descend into even greater levels of division.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a name that defined Iran's nuclear energy program. The top Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated in November last year. In terms of who was behind the incident, Iran has from the outset pointed the finger at Israel. Israel has a track record of killing Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth to be targeted. While Iran has revealed that it has tracked down some of those involved in the attack, families of the slain nuclear scientists have separately initiated a lawsuit at Iran's Court for International Affairs, not against Israel, but against the United States for, quote, systemic support for Israel's terrorist activities against Iran. The lead lawyer of the lawsuit says if the case is certified, Iran can freeze American assets in some countries and transfer them as compensation to the families of the victims.
The families of the slain scientists demand that the masterminds of the attacks be punished. Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's crimes. The case will be reviewed at Iran's Court for International Affairs, and then we will take further legal proceedings at an international scale. This is to relieve part of the pain inflicted on the families of the victims.
Iran says the assassination of its scientists pursues a single goal, to deal a heavy blow to the country's nuclear program. But the emotional side effects are even heavier to bear for the families of the victims, like 14-year-old Armita, who lost her father when she was only four. She says she will never forgive those who took away her dream. Israel has not commented on any of the assassinations of the Iranian scientists. But as to the last one, it has already spilled the beans on itself. Fakhrizadeh had long been on Israel's hit list. This remark by the Israeli Prime Minister perhaps says it all.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But this time around, Iran was quick to respond. Days ago, the country resumed enriching uranium to 20% purity, surpassing the 3.67% cap set by the 2015 nuclear deal. While Tehran interprets the elimination of its nuclear scientists as nothing but an attempt to derail its nuclear program, the hunt for those culpable in Fakhrizadeh assassination is placing the remaining pieces of the puzzle, which observers say is giving stronger clues of an Israeli link to the issue. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An official ceremony was held at the Assad House for Art and Culture in Damascus, marking the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria delivered a word condemning the assassination crime and asserting that the Iranian people have taken revenge and continue to do so. He also reiterated his country's ongoing support to the Syrian people and army until the full defeat of terror.
The criminal act perpetrated by the U.S. administration is against all international laws and the U.N. Charter. It is an act rejected by the entire world. The assassination proves the failure of the aggressive plot aimed at supporting terrorism and spreading instability in this region.
The event was attended by a wide range of high-ranking officials. Dr. Boutaina Shaban, who was representing Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in the ceremony, said the U.S. assassinated General Soleimani out of fear of his successful strategy that undermined their plots in the region, stressing Syrians will learn many lessons from the general's life. On the sideline of the ceremony, an exhibition was held shedding light on General Soleimani's life and focusing on his achievements in the fight against terror in Syria and Iraq in the past decade. A year after Lieutenant General Soleimani's assassination, Syrians are clearly keen to demonstrate their respect to his sacrifices for their country. Ceremonies held across the country express the high level of appreciation everyone here has for what the general had offered for the security of Syrian territories. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Following the landslide victory of Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party in last December's legislative election, former Information Minister Jorge Rodriguez has now been appointed as the new Speaker of the Nation's Congress, also known as National Assembly. Rodriguez, who is widely regarded as one of President Nicolas Maduro's closest allies, has claimed that the newly elected Congress will work exhaustively to promote the policies of the country's president. The assumption of Rodriguez as head of parliament puts an end to a five-year-long control of the congressional body by the opposition, through which the spat between the executive and the legislative produced political turmoil in the Latin American Republic. Socialist lawmakers praised the designation of Rodriguez, although in the opposition some complain about the new head of parliament. Nonetheless, experts believe that the new parliament is a politically balanced body now. Now that Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has regained control of the country's Congress, many believe that President Maduro is more stable than ever in his office. While the opposition has hit bottom in political terms, Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Unemployment rates among Turkish youth have increased dramatically in the recent period, especially after the outbreak of the new coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest figures released by the Turkish Statistical Institute, the unemployment rate was 12.7% in September 2020. Turkish government says reviving economy is among its priorities amid the pandemic. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed not to allow foreign factors negatively affect the country's economy.
It is not possible for a state to survive in long term with rising unemployment. So we have developed various plans to revive our economy, turning it into one of the 10 largest economies in the world by equal distribution of wealth among our population.
As part of efforts to stop declining employment, the government has banned companies from firing employees during the pandemic. So it prevents us from seeing the direct effect of the coronavirus on unemployment. We cannot see it in numbers, but we can definitely see it on the ground. This is how economists explain.
Unemployment is one of the biggest economic problems in the world, and Turkey is no exception. Despite our government's projects to lower the unemployment rates, unfortunately the numbers are rising, especially amid the pandemic that has paralyzed the economic sector.
The government say it plans to lower the unemployment rate to 10.9% in 2023. However, it seems that it all depends on how the country plans to recover from a pandemic and the lira crisis. As observers say, the main strength point of the ruling party has been flourishing economy and low unemployment. And now, with the pandemic continuing more and more, the country is witnessing the ruling party's popularity sliding further. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Wise versus Fool. All people have immature minds, with the exception of those who rise to the level of the sensible and wise and realize the truth in terms of understanding, action, and knowledge. A truly wise and sensible man is the one who worships Allah alone without associating partners with Him, who keeps away from whims and desires, who avoids to sink to the level of the immoral, the foolish, and the reckless, and safeguards himself against the stigma of ignorance, sinfulness, and disobedience to Allah. And another quality of a wise man, a truly wise man, is that he seeks to draw nearer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, asks for His forgiveness, and turns to Him in repentance. This type of a person is someone who you can call a wise person. Unfortunately, today, these terms have been changed. These terms have been altered. Today, many of our youths, they look at filthy rich people. They look at people who have lots of money, lots of cars, and all the branded clothes, and so on and so forth, right? Now, when they look at it, they go like, this person is really wise. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to get all of these worldly blessings. Guess what, brothers and sisters? It is not necessarily true. We're not saying that all these blessings are wrong and bad. What we are saying is this is not the criteria of someone being wise according to the teachings of Islam. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the wise and the fool, the wise versus the fool. Sometimes our youth, they get distracted and they get alluded to something which is not real. And that illusion is that somebody who is filthy rich is considered to be wise in the eyes of our youth today. Why? Because their standards are material. They're looking at the material success in this world to be a sign of wisdom. Guess what? Islam says that's not necessarily the case. Not every rich person, not every person who has a huge big house and a sports car and let's say, you know, all the other material blessings, that they are not necessarily the wisest of all people. How Islam defines a wise person is someone who knows who he is, where he is, and where he is headed. This is someone who recognizes his Lord being Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is someone who understands that he's been sent to this earth with a purpose of life. Now, associating partners with Allah is the most foolish thing one can do. Shirk in Islam means placing someone equal to that of Allah, or in other words, ascribing a partner or rival to Allah in lordship, worship, or in His names and attributes. There are two types of shirk. One is the greater shirk and the other is the lesser shirk. Greater shirk nullifies your deeds and land you in hellfire for all eternity. Allah does not forgive those who commit greater shirk. no one equals to the Almighty, and by placing anyone or anything beside him in worship or otherwise is a major sin. The other thing is the lesser sin that we don't have time to talk about, but know that shirk is one of those things that only a foolish would carry out. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z.